It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, can Wisconsin become the Napa Valley of craft beer? That is one legislator's ambition with his proposed state beer commission.
First, we take a look at the state of alternative weekly papers locally, usually city-based papers that provide local news and cultural coverage, often with a snarkier edge than daily papers. The Baltimore Sun Media Group just finalized its purchase of the alternative weekly paper in that community, the Baltimore City Paper.
This news comes as other alternative weekly papers around the country struggle. The Boston Phoenix closed last year. The venerable Village Voice in New York City cut a bunch of popular writers. The Onion still has a strong online presence, but no more print issues.
There are a lot of alternative papers here in Wisconsin, though, like the Isthmus in Madison, the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee, and Volume 1 in Eau Claire.
We're looking at the state of alternative weekly papers now. Louis Fortas will join us in a moment. He's editor-in-chief and owner of the Shepherd Express. First, we'll hear from Tiffany Shackelford, executive director of the Association for Alternative News Media. Tiffany, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So another big change with the sale of the Baltimore City Paper at an alternative weekly. What's your reaction to this latest domino maybe to fall?
Well, I don't look at it as a domino as much as I look at it as, you know, interesting that a daily paper wants an alt-weekly because they are, in a lot of cases, and particularly in Baltimore, they're still profitable, and they've still got really interesting coverage that a lot of readers want.
And when the Baltimore City Paper comes under the rule of the other parent group, does that mean their content's going to change in any way that might worry you?
Well, we're told that, you know, that it won't, and the person that they've put in charge of the city paper is actually the former publisher who, you know, was with the Baltimore City Paper for years and years before. I think that's a good sign. I'd also point to, you know, I can't tell you exactly what will happen, and I'm not privy to any information that's not public about that, but I will point to, you know, other situations where a daily has bought an alt-weekly and it's actually gone quite well. The Chicago Reader, you know, was purchased by the Sun-Times, and now actually the Chicago Reader has, you know, is the one that's responsible for a lot of the weekend coverage in Sun-Times, and you know, has really had a lot of success within that organization.
Let's go to the basics. What does an alternative weekly paper bring to its community that the daily papers don't, that websites don't? What's their unique role?
Well, we have several unique roles. The first is very much that that tradition of speaking truth to power and to telling stories that, you know, often the corporate media or other kinds of media can't or won't tell. Often we're looking at, you know, pieces of society that maybe you don't or just didn't even know were there. The other thing is that we absolutely look at arts and culture as our bread and butter. And finally, something that you really don't see, particularly as, you know, the daily media is kind of also getting a little bit smaller, you know, the investigative journalism that, you know, really it does take a lot of money and a lot of energy to do, but is so important. So we really take pride in continuing to do those long-form narrative investigative stories. And finally, you know, we live and die by local. We are absolutely local, local, local. We focus on the communities that we are reporting on.
Now, you seem pretty optimistic about the prospects of alternative papers so far, but in an opinion piece we saw for the New York Times, an editor from the city paper said that lots of people think the alt-weekly is becoming irrelevant because of the internet. What's your response to that?
You know, we get that a lot. And to that I say, oh, we invented the internet. Not in the way that Al Gore did, certainly. But, you know, that tone, that tongue-in-cheek, that, you know, that kind of glib tone, that's been an alt-weekly mainstay for years and years. You know, I remind people that South by Southwest that's going on came out of the Austin Chronicle. I feel like there's, you know, a lot of interesting opportunity and a lot of things that, you know, as we move towards digital media more and more, can really actually work in the favor of alt weeklies. I'd also say that, you know, obviously media is changing completely, and we absolutely, you know, are changing with it. You know, a lot of our member papers are really going mobile, hard and fast, mobile first in their philosophy. So I really think that there's you know, that there's a lot of opportunity for all of media, but particularly our brand of it.
All right, Tiffany, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Have a good one.
That's Tiffany Shackelford, Executive Director of the Association for Alternative News Media.
Louis Fortas joins us now. He's Editor-in-Chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee. Louis, thanks for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Well, what was your initial reaction to the sale of the Baltimore City paper?
I think it was actually sold by one daily paper to another. I mean, it's Diamond Shamrock, I think, was the owner before. They were bought by a daily paper, or at least a corporate entity, before it was sold to this current corporate entity. So I don't think it's a whole lot of change.
We heard from Tiffany about the role of alternative weeklies around the country. Can you bring us home to Wisconsin a little bit and talk about the role that your paper and others play in the state?
Okay. If you look at the research that the sociologists have on community and all, newspapers have a unique role in creating a community and bringing people together that radio, television, now the internet, none of them are capable of tying a community together as a newspaper does. And the alternative weeklies are basically, as Tiffany pointed out, I mean, they're more courageous. They're willing to truly speak truth to power. I mean, we take risks. We hold accountable these, quote, ethically challenged elected officials. We will, be critical of corporations that are abusing the average people or the environment or whatever is going on. We're willing to take the risk. We're willing to basically be truthful, and people love that. People are loyal to our newspaper because we're willing to take these risks, and we're willing to try to, treat people like adults and talk to them like adults.
Now, we just got done talking with Tiffany Shackelford, Executive Director of the Association for Alternative News Media. She's pretty optimistic about the prognosis for alternative newspapers. And yet, the Boston Phoenix just closed last year. The Village Voice, which has been a mainstay for a long time, has been firing writers, some of them very popular, seemingly because they are under pressure, probably financial pressure. Do signs like that worry you?
Pardon me? The last.
Do signs like that worry you?
Well, certainly, our industry, like all media, is going through a transition. But you have to look back and you have to say there's a shakeout going on, and each medium is trying to figure out where they're going to fit. Radio didn't kill newspapers back when radio came into being. Television didn't kill radio. The internet is not going to kill radio. It's not going to kill television, and it's not going to kill newspapers. But there will be a shakeout, and we'll all find out, kind of where our role is. We're on the internet. We have an excellent website. It's expressmilwaukee.com. But again, the newspaper is a unique thing. I mean, newspapers, again, as the sociologists point out, they have a unique role. They do bring a community together like no other type of media can.
We've talked some about the news role and the truth to power aspect of the alternative weekly. How about kind of the cultural calendar aspect and getting maybe the underground cultural stuff out there into the mainstream? I know a lot of people point toward that as a big role of the alternative weekly.
I mean, culture is oftentimes what leads a society forward. And the thing that the alternative newspapers have always done, and the Shepherd is definitely in there swinging away at this, and we're the ones that are going after the avant-garde, the edgy, the stuff that 10 years from now will be considered mainstream, but right now it's experimental and the like. And these are the things that the alternative newspapers are not afraid to deal with. They're not afraid to offend various people. They're willing to, call it the way it is.
We're talking about the state of alternative weekly papers with Louis Fortas, the owner of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee.
And we want to know what you think about the state of alternative newspapers in the U.S. What about newspapers in general? Do you think they're a thing of the past, or is there room for them in the new media landscape? Do you regularly read alternative weekly papers or use alternative media? We're picking up our discussion on the state of alternative weekly media with Louis Fortas, editor-in-chief and owner of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee.
We're taking your calls now. What do you think about the state of alternative news media in the United States? Do you think they're a thing of the past, or do you appreciate what they do? Are you a regular reader of one of Wisconsin's weeklies? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at talk@WPR.org. We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Rocker with us in Madison. Rocker, hi.
Hey, Rob, what's happening, man? I was driving around delivering Maximum Make Music magazine, and we've been a magazine here monthly for 18 years in Wisconsin. And I was listening to the story. I thought there were some great points from the Shepherd Express publisher about community building, and I think that was a great point. But I think with things like the Onion going to digital and stuff like that, it really actually opened it up. So I think there's more opportunity for some of these papers that are still alive. And there's great length in, I think, what they're going to do. And I agree, internet isn't going to kill newspapers. And I'm still here. We turn 18 on March 7th. Just did.
All right, Rocker, thanks a lot for the call. Louis Fortas making the point that as a lot of other things, other venues have disappeared, there's more room for alternative weeklies and others to do what they do.
Well, I think, like with most things, if you do what your mission is and you do it well, there's room for you. I didn't create the Shepherd. Vince O'Hearn in Madison did create the Isthmus and has been running it the whole life of the Isthmus. I got involved about 15 years ago. But the Shepherd is 31 years old. The Isthmus is, I think, about 36 years old. So, I mean, these publications have been around a long time, and there's a real loyal readership. We have, this is according to Media Audit, a third-party surveying company, we have 253,000 readers, and I try to explain that to people. I say, you fill up Brewer Stadium, and you empty it out, and then you fill it up again, and you empty it out. And you do that over six times, and you have everybody standing together. That's our readership. And when we put out over 60,000 papers a week, and we have a return rate somewhere between 2 or 4%, so 96 to 98% of our papers get picked up every week. You know, that's not falling, and, you know, hopefully it won't start. But, I mean, you know, there's still a strong strong support for the newspaper and strong support for, you know, the alternative press.
Louis, one of the things that alternative papers are known for doing especially well is having writing with a lot of voice, a lot of character, a lot of personality, sometimes a bit of snark thrown in there. Is that at all in danger when, say, a bigger company, say the Sun Media Group, comes in and buys one of these alt-weeklies?
Yes, I think it's a big problem. I remember the first time the organization that Tiffany represents, the Shepherd's, of course, a member, and the first time a daily was going to purchase, it was a Hartford newspaper was buying the papers in the Hartford area, and the there was, you know, big discussion of, you know, should we throw them out of the association? Problem was, the guy who was the publisher was so popular that we said, okay, we'll give him a chance. You know, the publication that's buying him is saying that they're going to give this independence, they're going to continue to let the paper be independent, and they pretty much did. But there are other, you know, other papers where it's a self-censorship. They don't tell you don't print this. But you know, the writers or the editors are going to be saying, well, you know, if we print that, you know, we're going to be hearing from the folks upstairs, so we better censor ourselves. That's the danger, is when the self-censorship comes in, and that's why it's so important to try to keep these things independently owned.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Franklin. Mike, hi.
Hi. I look forward every week to getting a new Shepherd Express. And the reason I enjoy it is because, and like me, I'm a big political junkie, and what I can do is I read stories where it's like they print everything. It's like in the Journal, the reporters are afraid to maybe go after Walker or go after Paul Ryan, because it's like then their staff won't have the access to them anymore. And the thing I like about the Shepherd is they put it out there, and I mean, There's no baloney. It's facts, check stuff, and that's what I enjoy.
Thanks a lot for the call. Mike, probably no argument there, Lewis, but you ought to run with that idea.
I was going to say, yeah, no argument is right. thank you. So there is a situation where, you know, we offend certain people, and there are certain people that have politicized their advertising and will not advertise with us because of the fact that we have an opinion. And I think the thing I think that's very important is every article, every newspaper, every publication has an opinion. We're just more honest about it. We basically, you know, say that we're basically coming from a, you know, more democratic side of the aisle, a more liberal, more progressive, whatever term you want to use. But there's no such thing as objective journalism. And the other publications that try to say that, you know, are just kidding themselves.
So part of the appeal of an alt-weekly paper is original reporting on topics that might not get covered by more mainstream publications. And given the problems the industry is seeing in some cases right now, do you think that kind of reporting could be in jeopardy?
I think, again, going back to your point earlier, as these papers, a number of the people who, you know, started these papers are getting close to retirement age, and you know, how do you, what do you do with it? How do you transfer it? And one of the people, one of the entities that are buying them are, would be these daily papers, because they need people reading newspapers, and people are reading fewer and fewer daily papers, but they're still reading the alternative papers. And if you keep them in the habit of, this is the argument that they have used, if you keep them in the habit of reading a paper, they're more apt to continue to read the daily also. So they're trying desperately, the dailies, to stay relevant. And that's why the alt papers are important to them. But so I think that the alt papers will continue to be the way they are as long as they're independently owned.
Back to our callers now with Chris in Middleton. Chris, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Apparently all this fearless speaking of power pays off, because study after study of alt weeklies, like Shepherd Express, Isthmus here in Madison, City Pages in the Twin Cities, shows that their reader demographics are higher, are wealthier than those of newspapers. And I think part of the result then is that you have an elite-ish cast to the paper and you're not going to offend those folks.
Gotcha. I'm not a little trouble hearing your line, Chris, but the gist, Lewis, higher income demographic for weekly papers and maybe an elitist cast to the alternative weeklies as compared to daily newspapers, say.
According to Media Audit, again, the surveying group, the alt papers will take the Shepherd compared to the Journal, for example, that our readers are better educated on average, higher income on average. There are, you know, a tremendous number of professionals. I think the last survey had 19% of our readers have advanced degrees. So, yes, it's a smart audience and a creative audience. And I think having an audience like that, you pitch to an audience like that. So you treat people like an adult. You call it the way it is. And anything short of that would disappoint these intelligent readers.
Lewis, you were saying before that we're in a period of shifting grounds for media in general, and that there's going to be some different shakedowns in the way these papers land and the way things are positioned in the future. But what do you think the future will look like for alt weeklies at this point?
I think it'll be a combination of the newspaper along with our website, where you basically extend the newspaper on the website and use the website also to drive people to certain things in the newspaper. So it's going to be a back and forth. But I think together they will have a role. Will there still be 253,000 readers in the Milwaukee area? There may be more. I don't know. Will we be printing the same number of papers? Probably over time we'll be printing fewer papers. But I think that there will still be a significant readership of the paper. Between the combination between the web and the newspaper, I think will continue to grow.
All right, Lewis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you guys for having me.
That was Lewis Fortas, editor-in-chief and owner of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee. He was with us to talk about the state of alternative media, especially alternative weekly newspapers, in light of the news that a major one, the Baltimore alternative weekly paper, was bought out by a media group.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to an editor at Discover Magazine about some of the coolest science stories of the month, including a new way archaeologists are discovering lost cities.
First, can Wisconsin become the Napa Valley of craft brewing? Representative Gary Tauchin of Bonwell says that's his goal in trying to create the Wisconsin Beer Commission.
Wisconsin ranks 11th in the country for the number of breweries per capita, and in addition to researching and promoting these breweries, the commission would focus on trying to promote beer tourism, something like the wine tours of California.
Here with us to share her thoughts on the state of Wisconsin craft brewing and where it might be heading is Deborah Carey. She's the founder and president of New Glarus Brewing Company. New Glarus Brewery has twice been named one of the world's 10 best breweries at the World Brewery Championship. Deb, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, what do you think about this prospect of creating a Wisconsin Beer Commission?
Well, I think it's an exciting idea. Wisconsin craft brewers, while we get a lot of play, probably more than our fair share of press coverage from people like yourself, we're still only 5% of all the beer sold in the state of Wisconsin, which I think is a little bit shocking because I've been running this brewery for almost, well, a little more, I guess, now than 20 years. And when I came here, it was craft beer is about 2.5% of all beer consumed in the state. And in 20 years, we've worked our way all the way up to 5%. So we still have a lot of room to grow. And I'm just really proud of the craft brewers of Wisconsin. When you look at awards, you know, where people are competing for beer quality, we always come out with many, many awards. I think there's 60 or 70 small brewers now in the state if you count all the little brew pubs. And we are really good for tourism because not only are we an agricultural manufacturers, but we also get a lot of visitors from out of state. I know just in my own brewery, we see about 200,000 people a year coming through here. And, you know, I'm not alone. Sprecher, Capital, Point, everybody sees a lot of people coming through looking at not just breweries, but stopping for lunch and checking out the cheese makers and chocolate makers and all the other things there are to do in this wonderful state.
So let's say that Representative Tauchin is successful and there is a creation of a Wisconsin Beer Commission. What kind of difference do you think it'll make in the way that Wisconsin beer is perceived in Wisconsin and around the country?
Well, you know, the road to success is paved with many little pitfalls. And one of the things that craft brewers have been running into is less than supportive legislation. We all sell our beer under the thing called the three-tier system, which I very much support, and I value my wholesale and retail partners. However, over the last 15 years, there has been a concentrated effort to kind of tip favoritism toward the other tiers and away from small brewers. So we've lost some real things of value. And I think that by having a beer commission, there's a possibility that there'll be a group of legislators that will, you know, take the reins and pay attention to our job creation and also, you know, a way to help market ourselves in a along with the State Department of Tourism, you know, to be a little more at the forefront. You know, people sometimes are not aware that while we are this very small percentage of beer sold, the 5%, but we're 50% of all jobs created. And craft brewers, you know, all of these, you know, 60 or 70 people, I forget exactly the number, that are in production currently, our cost of construction for our bricks and mortar is upwards of $2,000 a square foot. So we are really the backbone and really investing hard in our state.
Do you think it's feasible that Wisconsin could become a beer destination, you know, along the lines of Napa Valley and the way they are to wine? Is that a possibility?
Well, I think that a lot of people are surprised that we're not. I talk to people all the time that are very shocked that Wisconsin is kind of middle of the pack as far as craft breweries in the state are. You know, other states have many more craft brewers than we do. All along each coast, you know, pick a state, Washington, Oregon, California, they all have many, many more craft brewers than we do. So do I think we can get that back? You bet. I'm pretty proud of our state. I think that people in this state have great educations, and they're parochial in their buying habits, and they pay attention to where their food comes from. And I think that we're just at the forefront, really, of a real exciting time to be a small brewer in this state.
What do you think the craft beer industry can learn from, say, the way Wisconsin cheese is marketed?
Well, that's kind of an interesting thing because having been here forever now, the Specialty Cheese Association had come years ago to talk to me about how I was marketing. And so I think we're, you know, actually a little bit ahead of the curve, you know, and now we can trade information back and forth. But what I think overall is that people really are hungry for information, and they love to know the story of where their food comes from. It's an easy conversation. It's nice to know that your money is staying in the state. You know, we pay a lot in taxes, but we also employ lots of people, and we're good revenue creators in our areas. You know, all of us, when you give a tour or, you know, somebody comes by to see the brewery, then they head into town to go have dinner or stay at the hotel, or they need their car fixed or buy a house here. You know, so I think that people understand that, and craft brewers and cheesemakers will always be great partners.
Now, I read that Wisconsin is something like 10th or 11th in the production of craft beer nationwide. If there were a Wisconsin Beer Commission, do you think that would help propel Wisconsin further up the list?
Well, I think it would, because if it could level the playing field with all of our regulatory issues, and that would be a nice thing. And also, if there were just you know, focus on the tourism, or even some simple things like road signs that say, you know, this way to Minhas or Capital Brewery, that would be a great thing.
And you talked a little bit about some of the challenges that craft breweries face, but in particular, what do you think is outstanding that really needs to be addressed to move the industry?
Well, it's very hard for a craft brewer to start, and one of the big things is trying to get their feet under them in regards to distribution. And at this particular juncture, small brewers are really at a disadvantage. And, you know, that has been done with some thought and effort from other teams. And, you know, I'm hopeful that that might turn around. One thing that I've been very vocally upset about was when I started the brewery, and up until a couple years ago, brewers were always required to have a wholesaler license. And if things went, you know, very badly somewhere, at least I would be able to deliver my own beer. Now I'm looking at $32 million of bricks and mortar investment in the state. And the fact is that if all of a sudden I was without a wholesaler, you know, I don't know how I would get the beer to the market. I wouldn't be able to do it except for a short period of time on my own.
What is the top thing that you want the people of Wisconsin to know about why craft beer matters in Wisconsin?
Well, I think craft beer matters for a whole number of reasons. For one, if you're ignoring craft beer, you are missing out on, you know, a rainbow of flavor that really should not be missed. It is one of the most economical ways to enjoy flavor. It, you know, beer can be sour or bitter or, you know, really malty or sweet. We age it in bourbon barrels. We add fruit. There's light beers and dark beers and beers made with wheat and caramely beers and, you know, everything under the sun. And so it's really fun to pair with food and cheese, and you're missing out on a very obtainable richness if you ignore craft beer. But in addition to that, why it's good for the state is, like I said, our job creation, the enormous amount of taxes that we pay, you know, because we pay our regular payroll and property tax like everybody else, but we also have an extra special surcharge for the privilege of making beer. But also, I just think that it's nice to know where your food comes from. And when you get around and start to meet brewers and see their story and see how complicated the process of making beer is, it gives everybody a newfound respect. And I think that's something that the big brewers kind of took away from Americans in general. They've spent a lot of time promoting beer as kind of a commodity or a vehicle to meet girls who pop out of sand dunes. But in fact, it's a food product with a rich heritage.
Deborah, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Victoria. Appreciate the call.
We've been talking to Deborah Carey, founder and president of New Glarus Brewing Company. Wisconsin State Representative Gary Talke would like to create a Wisconsin Beer Commission to promote the state's breweries.
A new issue of Discover Magazine hits newsstands tomorrow. One of the editors is with us now to give a preview of some of the top stories in this month's issue.
Our guest is Gemma Tarlak. She's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hi, great to be with you guys again.
So a lot of cool stuff in this issue that we have to discuss today. One cool thing coming up has to do with a new way to discover lost cities, LIDAR. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, actually, and, you know, I love that word because it makes me think of something Dr. Evil would have, you know, sharks that shoot LIDAR. But it's short for light detection and ranging, and it is a laser scanning technology that it's been used a little bit in Mesoamerica, but for the first time, they used it at Angkor, the site in Cambodia that we all recognize from National Geographic and Angelina Jolie movies. It's that fantastic temple complex, and they had a helicopter just pass over the site back and forth for hours and hours and hours, and it shot out these little laser pulses. It shot out 200,000 of them per second. And when I read that statistic, my head just kind of exploded. But so it shot these laser pulses down into the dense jungle, and the pulses were able to penetrate the vegetation and actually give them the most accurate, detailed topography of what's beneath all the vegetation. And they found the size of the city and the organization, the complexity, is far greater than they thought. Just an easy statistic to bring it home. It's got a suburban area three times the size of Atlanta.
Wow.
I mean, if you've ever been stuck on a freeway in Atlanta, you know that's pretty impressive. And this is all back in the 12th century. It's pretty amazing.
And right now, or up till now, it was as if, you know, you had a picture of Madison in the future. All you had was the state capitol and the Capitol Square, and that's all you knew about the town. That's kind of the exponential scale this expands our understanding, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And they really have a much better appreciation for the degree of organization. I mean, they had planning to avoid flooding the homes. They had these special ponds built in the same alignment that they could tell this was planned. This wasn't just a guy in the backyard saying, hey, my neighbor's house never gets flooded. I'll do what he's doing. So they really show just the incredible amount of organization that was, you know, part of this capital city of the Lost Khmer Empire.
What do the images coming back look like after these laser pulses are sent down?
Well, they do a variety of different treatments of the data that comes back in, and some of them are these gorgeous, multicolored, kind of three-dimensional maps. Others are just sort of black and white, very stark, almost schematic-looking. But they can manipulate the data that comes in all different ways. They can separate, say, modern roads from evidence of medieval roads and just give it all different kinds of treatment to develop a better understanding, not only of what was there, but when it was built. They're actually able to tell from the laser scanning technology kind of the rough chronology of when things appeared.
This really changes my image of how archaeology will be done, from the cinematic version of Lara Croft or Indiana Jones hacking their way through the jungle with machetes and swinging over traps, or the real way, which is probably grad students with machetes painstakingly dusting off pottery shards. And this really changes archaeology, doesn't it?
You know, it does, and I have a few friends who are archaeologists, and none of them own fedoras, but they're all field people, you know, and I can see this really kind of revolutionizing their field, but in a good way. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there will always be the option to, you know, put on the khaki shorts and the hiking boots and go out into the jungle, but now when you're going out into the jungle, you have such a better roadmap. I mean, before, really, the only way to determine the contours of the city, the lost city, was to kind of go out there with with the machete. Now you can have your data points. You can, you know, reference that on that battery-powered tablet you've got in your hand, and boom, you're probably able to get much more research done in a single field season, much more accurate, too, than ever before.
But they're not done once they take those LIDAR images. Then they can go to the ground and know exactly where to start digging.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, let's move on to one of the other features in this month's magazine, this one about Matt Lewin, an expedition physician. First of all, let's talk about what exactly is an expedition physician.
Well, speaking of fedoras.
he's got a real one.
Yeah, right? Well, actually, I have to say he's kind of my hero. He's had an amazing career. He started out kind of as an amateur paleontologist, but decided he wanted to be this doctor who had exotic adventures, and he made it happen. He went to medical school, got a PhD, also practiced in an emergency room for a while, decided it wasn't for him, and I have to say the writer, Eric Vance, did an amazing job kind of conveying the emotional battle that Matt Lewin experienced when he decided ER medicine wasn't for him. But he got involved in basically expedition medicine. Doctors in very remote places, they don't have access to most of the tools that doctors in Milwaukee or Madison would have. And so they've got to deal with emergencies, whether it's an outbreak of an unknown illness, someone getting their leg crushed by a fossil falling on it, that was something Matt had to deal with, or even someone choking. You know, one of the most vivid images in the story to me was a new use for a safety pin. With a choking victim, you can pin their tongue to their cheek with a safety pin to keep them from choking.
Wow.
I think you want to be a doctor to try that.
Yeah, wow. Let's all think about that mental image for a while.
Well, it changed the way, again, we think about how science is done. Because when I think of science work, an image of a lab pops into my head. But
Right. There
are people out in really remote places around the world doing primatology, geology, astronomy, you name it, far from a hospital.
Right. And not only that, but a lot of the folks on these expeditions, you know, they're dealing with jackhammers. They're dealing with heavy equipment. They've got to move fossils that maybe, you know, they may weigh hundreds of pounds. And again, if you drop it, if you're in a mudslide situation, say, some of these jungle situations are, you know, not exactly safe to begin with, you can be bitten by any number of things or contract any number of diseases. So it's really incredible what they do, what these expedition doctors do with the barest of essentials.
And it's kind of fascinating to see what he puts in his must-have survival kit. It's not all stuff I would think you would want. You mentioned the safety pins, but you know, he always brings sugar along with him for another.
Yeah, that one fascinated me. He brings it along just because, you know, you can't be sure that a diabetic, say, is going to remember to bring a source of sugar, you know, to help them. And he also cleans wounds with it. I mean,
really?
He also talks about using honey as a dressing, which actually they did that in antiquity. I know the Roman army used honey as a wound dressing, but he's experimenting with ways of making it even more efficacious.
So one more story we have to talk about today, a new documentary about the finding of the Higgs boson particle, particle fever. What did you learn about the successful search ultimately for the Higgs boson?
Well, I was able to talk to David Kaplan, who is a physicist and also the producer and kind of the brainchild of this movie. And, you know, he said it best. He was in the middle of all the preparation for the opening of the Large Hadron Collider outside Geneva, and he realized we are making history here. So he, at first, took his camera and started filming all these little moments and incidents during the build-up to the opening of the facility. Then he realized he wasn't such a great filmmaker, so he got a professional team to do the filming and the editing and everything. Really some stellar, got some Oscar winners on board in the crew. And they captured, you know, we all know the science, the Higgs boson, why it's important, why, you know, how it was discovered, what it means, et cetera. But they really captured the human side of what's going on. You know, I think a lot of times we hear about these huge scientific discoveries, and it's just science, you know, it's a bunch of numbers, it's a bunch of data. We don't think about the guy who comes home at night to his family and is tucking his kids into bed, and this really puts a human face on it. I mean, they fight, they argue, they, you know, they have hopes and dreams, and it's wonderful. It follows about half dozen physicists from all different disciplines within the field, all different ages, all different stages of their career, and it follows them through the build-up to firing up the Large Hadron Collider and then actually finding the Higgs boson, confirming the data. And you really feel like you're there and see just a really fascinating side that I think a lot of times you don't see when we're talking about particle physics.
And, Jem, in our last 20 seconds here, there's still a lot we don't know about the Higgs, right?
That's right, yeah. And that kind of ends on a cliffhanger, all these tantalizing possibilities, but maybe that'll be in the sequel.
Well, we can watch for that. Jemma, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Jemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine. They're based in Waukesha. She joins us each month to bring us some of the coolest stories from the world of science.